Hello everyone and welcome to Ask Margot today. I'm Margot de Coatsworth and I'm here to answer your questions that might be keeping you a little bit stuck in life. I was recently thinking about what I call our identifier, which is our I am statements. If I asked you, without thinking, to quickly answer off the top of your head, tell me how you would finish this statement. I am. Now you must add another word. Don't think about it. Just say it. I am. Would you say I'm happy? Would you say I'm fine? Would you say I'm not amused? Seriously though, I think it's a very interesting question for us to ask ourselves. How is it that we see ourselves? What's the first thing we think about ourselves? It's not always a goodie. It may be, I'm getting older. I'm forgetting. I'm worried. It might be, I'm alone. I'm lonely. It might be, I'm great. It might be, I'm good. I wonder what the identifying thought was for you. I sometimes play a little game in my car when I'm driving, and I go through the alphabet, and with the I am statements, I add each letter of the alphabet a word that relates to what I would like to feel or what I am feeling. This is a state shifter, a mood elevator, and a statement of truth about our value. It's usually a mix for me of what I have and what I want. You are appreciating the good things you have when you do this, and in some level, you are pulling into existence, declaring what it is that you want in what I call the unseen. So I have a statement I say, and sometimes I'll introduce myself saying, I'm Margot de Coatsworth, like I do on this show, and I am, and then I begin my little list, the ultimate statements of how I see myself. Always start with I am amazing, which is your declaration of your self-worth. I went to dinner the other day to a friend's and I couldn't help notice how apologetic he was about many things. Oh, it's not quite tidy enough, or not quite clean enough, or the food was not cooked through enough, or it was too hot or too cold, or the not enough statements. You know what I mean? There was just a scattering of this kind of apology, low-level apology, through the whole evening about how things weren't quite as he wanted them to be. Next time I go, I think I'm going to preface our time together by saying to him, don't apologize for anything tonight. Just don't do it. Because I notice for myself, especially around food, which is one of my things, if something's not right about what you've cooked, and you know it, it doesn't mean that the other person has noticed it. If your socks don't match, it doesn't mean the other person has noticed, or that they don't think it's deliberate and that you're terribly creative. People don't know about the dusty corners of your house, or that you haven't done the cobwebs right up in the ceiling for a while. They don't know you need to sort your bathroom cupboard. It's hard, I know. But we really need to be sure to encourage ourselves by saying positive things rather than allowing our concern for the things that are not quite right to infuse so many aspects of our lives. We apologize for our bodies. We apologize for our dress. We apologize for the temperature of the room. I do that. But we must stop those things. I guess what I'm trying to say is choose one dazzling statement for yourself and make it your own. Say it to yourself often and stop apologizing for every little thing. Nobody actually feels good when that's happening. There's no benefit. We need to tell a different story about ourselves. We need to tell a great story about ourselves. And we need to be the ones to start that great story so that other people pick up on it. Because if we don't feel it, they don't get it. I've proven more than once that how I see myself is how others respond to me. If I feel curled up with my head under my wing, what I project to others is not something that's very magnetic. Nobody wants to be around that tragic kind of apologetic energy. We can't help that we want to be around people who make us feel good, who make us feel positive about life and even a bit inspired. It's so easy to go down a rabbit hole of tragedy, talking about things getting worse and the sky falling and the world has gone mad. This is so much of the talk that's around at the moment. It absolutely shuts out any kind of progressive conversation. And the first thing people come back to is the economic climate or how tough it is and how businesses are closing. It's so hard out there, no one's got any money. It's a bit self-fulfilling, I think, and we should be choosing something better. If we don't, it's like fueling a fire that gets bigger and bigger and more dominant. Let's come up with solutions. Let's find another way. Let's surround ourselves with a different perspective. I do choose, in a way, to stay within my bubble of thinking. I mean that I don't want to talk about being tragic or hopeless or that we're doomed. If people talk about that, I just say, oh, really? I hadn't noticed. That's not because I'm ignorant, and it's not because I don't think we need to empathise and sympathise and that we feel we need to do something to be a part of the solution for everything bad that's going on in the world. We do need to participate. It's just that I'm not going to allow my life to be chewed up and dominated by that kind of hopelessness. If you want to complain about what's wrong, then at least suggest a positive spin on it to solve the problem. Wouldn't it be great if instead of talking about what the problem is, we could spend our clever creative energy in thinking up ideas for what we think we could do individually and collectively to address it? If you are surrounded by people who are always talking doom and gloom, have a go at turning the conversation. What should we do about it? And if that doesn't work, move away from them and get out of that energy and away from that kind of thinking, because it doesn't do anybody any good. It's not helping you, it's not helping them, it's not helping people on the receiving end and the ripple effect of that. We have a question today from Ursula wanting to know about the power of prayer and what to pray about without influencing a situation wrongly. This is such an interesting question because we are always tempted to influence what we are asking God for with what we personally believe is the right outcome of a situation. And we may or may not be right about what we think. Sometimes we come across a situation in business or family or friendship where it's hard to see what the best outcome would be. In a romantic situation, for example. How can we pray correctly to help and not be counter to what the outcome could be that's better than one we have seen or thought of? For example, should one continue in a business or leave a job or a relationship? Those are really big decisions and questions. But we don't know the future, so we have to be very careful when we give advice to another person, or in this case, if we feel our prayer has influence, what we pray for. I've personally come across a situation like this a couple of times recently where I didn't want to influence the outcome for someone else when I really didn't know what the best course of action for that person would be. I couldn't know. So here's what you do. You wish them well, or you might say you bless them. So never go into something like this with a bad attitude. You just can't take that kind of energy into this. Never. Only wish good for another person for the outcome. You can do this by saying your desire for the situation is for the best and highest good for all concerned. You don't actually have to tell the universe or God how to do it or how you see it. If you don't know the specifics, then just make your heavenly order for the best and highest good or outcome for all concerned. So that's how you pray when you don't know what to pray for, but when you have a deep concern for a situation. Even if you look at things like the strife in the world and the arguments on both sides, don't get bogged down in any of that. People are people. All individuals are beings of immeasurable worth. before we're part of any ethnic group or nationality or cause or anything else. So in those kinds of situations that are multifaceted and quite complex and have good and bad on both sides, this is how you pray. You say a blessing over the situation and the people for the best and highest good of all. God sees the big picture. He can decide how it's best sorted. One group of people are not intrinsically better than another group, any more than they are worth more than another group. We forget that often, and we think that our people are the most important. I'm not saying we abdicate our responsibility. I'm saying don't impose your limited perspective of what's right on others unless you have some kind of special insight about what to say or what action to take. I'm a therapist and a coach, and as such, anybody who works in these fields knows that they must detach. They must care about people, but not take on another person's burden. You can't do that as a parent, though it's so tempting, and you can't do it as a teacher. We really shouldn't be doing that for another person at all. I'm not saying we shouldn't support people and care and help, but we mustn't take on the emotional weight of something outside of us like that, as though it was our burden to bear. It isn't. And if we take on that kind of burden, which is also called worrying, then we're not helping anybody. Feeling burdened or worrying on behalf of someone else is not helpful to the recipient, and it's not helpful for the worrier. Worrying just shuts you down and makes you prematurely old. The trick is to learn to care and then detach, and still care, but still stay detached. We do need to speak up and say when things are off in the world and say that's got to stop. But the trick is not to carry the burden of it. We've talked a bit about how to ensure you're doing your bit to keep a relationship in the happy ever after zone in the last couple of episodes. And last episode I talked about making it a priority to ensure that you do something each day to keep your other person happy. In a post-episode chat with Ulysses, our radio names today begin with the letter U, he told me he had found it was a great thing in his long-distance relationship to check in at the end of the day and then identify how that other person had made the day happier for them, that connected them that day. It might be a timely or meaningful text or call. It might be remembering something important or just a tiny little thing that shows you were thinking of them. He said that had worked brilliantly for him. One of the most romantic things I've ever been on the receiving end of were songs being sent to me. Even though that relationship didn't last for the duration, whenever I hear some of those songs now, I'm completely undone. So that clearly worked if years later it had such a lasting residual effect. I know someone else who cut out little romantic sayings from magazines and put them under her partner's pillow. She gave him a box to keep them in under the bed. That's quite romantic. This could be a fun time to think about what the most romantic thing you've been on the receiving end of could be, and then ask yourself, what's the most romantic thing you have ever done? If you're a bit disappointed about what you've received, now is the time to take a close look at what you have offered in this respect. Maybe you should say you can't receive romance if you're not giving romance. That's not very good English. Sometimes people get so tied up with the everyday stuff of life that they forget they have a little bit of romance inside them waiting to get out. When is the last time you let yours out to play? I did a survey once on love and romance when I was doing research for one of my books. I'll touch on that now as it answers some questions we've had about making love last and finding the person who's a right match for you. I've also looked at a few statistics here which are quite interesting. So, how would you subtly show someone you're interested in them? Apparently, eye contact, and over 60% of people say this, is the first signal. Body language, mirroring, leaning closer, an open posture. Voice, a softer tone, more laughter, asking questions. Other signals like a gentle touch, longer replies, and remembering details. We all love to be listened to and heard. And what are the indicators that someone is interested in you? Again, the eye contact, holding a gaze longer than you normally would, smiling, and physical orientation, facing towards somebody. An extra effort, just taking more time for somebody. Do you know also that if there is romantic music playing in the background, a girl is more likely to say yes to a date? There you are, gentlemen. Now, in these days, you can have music in your pockets. Another thing that's really important to think about is your non-negotiables. What are they in a mate? Would it be honesty, kindness, loyalty, fun, generosity? And what then also are the five most compelling qualities you offer a prospective mate? Because sometimes we say what we want and we forget to look at what we're offering. Do you offer humour, passion, loyalty, affection, constancy? I could go on and on with this survey because it was quite a long one, but I'm just going to finish with kissing. The average person spends 2 weeks of their life kissing. That doesn't seem very much in a lifetime, does it? And did you know that you can burn 26 calories per minute of kissing, if it's heartfelt? And that 8 in 10 people say a bad first kiss can kill attraction. One of my favourite sayings on this subject is, never let a fool kiss you, or a kiss fool you. It made me think of that Shoop Shoop song that Cher sang, It's in His Kiss. I was going to sing that for you, but unfortunately we don't have time today. Just a little insight to close with. Everyone has a love language, and we are often drawn to someone with a different one, which I hadn't realised. The magic is not only in discovering theirs, but in learning to speak it fluently. That's how love lasts the distance. I like that idea. I had a great conversation yesterday with someone, let's call him Ulrich, in pursuit of better things in life, and a number of questions came up in this time we were talking. One thing he said to me was that when people say to him, oh, life hasn't worked out for me and it's not fair and I haven't really got what I thought I'd have, my life isn't going to plan, he says to them, oh, well, tell me about your plan. And I thought, touche, how many people who say my life is not going to plan actually have a proper plan, an agenda that they're holding themselves to? I often like to look at statistics with these things because it really kind of brings a point home. So let's investigate that. Only 3% of adults have written goals. Studies from Harvard and Yale have shown that those 3% tend to achieve far more than the 97% who don't. People with written goals are 42% more likely to achieve them. I'm not sure how those two statistics work together, but you get the point. Write it down, make a plan. 83% of people don't even have goals. I've decided that statistics are quite malleable and flexible, so let's not worry too much about the exact figures, just look at the principles behind this. So if you want to make money or be rich, you probably aren't going to do that without a plan. With health, 80% of New Year's resolutions fail by February. Why? Because there's no clear plan, no change of self story. People who plan their meals and exercise are 2 to 3 times more likely to maintain their weight or improve health long term. The average person spends 2+ hours a day on social media. That's about 5 years of your life. That's quite sobering. One survey found that only 14% of workers are truly engaged in their jobs, meaning that 86% are living outside their desired plan. And I know it seems a bit of a dream to be working in a job that makes you happy, but it's got to be a plan. It's got to be something you work towards. I talked to this friend of mine about discipline, which is not always a word we want to hear, but it's one we need to employ if we want to stop whining about the things we're doing, like not getting enough sleep, because we're not holding ourselves accountable to a go-to-bed time, about being overweight, because we're not holding ourselves accountable for what we eat and what we shop for. I don't think we have to be military about how we approach these things, but we actually have to hold ourselves to account. People say to me, how can I do all these things when I've got to go to work and come home and cook dinner and I just don't have any time? Well, the truth is, we all have the same amount of time. And it's how we manage it that makes the difference. People who look like they've achieved so-called overnight success usually have spent years behind the scenes working towards it and planning. If your current lifestyle is the most important thing for you to preserve, that's going to bed when you feel like it, eating what you want, exercising or not, then that's probably the place you're going to stay. I'm sure you've heard of the five people principle, which is quite sobering. If you want more out of life, you've got to look around you and make sure that the people closest to you are what you're aspiring to. Live a life that you want. Studies show that friends and family shape up to 95% of our daily habits. If a close friend becomes overweight, the chances are you are likely to become more so. If you've got people around you who are happy, you're likely to become more so. If you've got people around you who are struggling financially, that has an influence on you. I'm not saying this is always the case, because you might be the dominant person who is drawing those people up to something more aspirational. But our brains are mirrors of what we see around us and what we feed into ourselves. If your circle complains, you complain, probably. If they talk possibility, you talk possibility. My point is that even if you don't succumb, and you're the one dominant person offering more and better, it's very hard work to be living like that all the time, and it doesn't feed your own path forward to your own dreams. If you want a dream to come true, then try to find people who also talk about dreams coming true. I remember a mother a while ago saying to me once, oh, he's just a dreamer, about her son. And I thought, well, that's fantastic. May his dreams come true. I got a message into my inbox the other morning that summed up this, and I want to read it to you. It's just a reminder, he says, to be who you say you are and do what you came here to do. I find that quite inspiring. Well, we've come to the end of our show today. Thank you for your fine company. If you do have questions, please send them through to us, either to me under the contact tab at margounlimited.com, Margo with a T, or to admin@coastaccessradio.org.nz. And of course, you can listen to past shows and other good things from Coast on Apple and Spotify as podcasts. Today we're going to finish with the word, as we always do, our message from the universe. And interestingly, this is not a recent message, but it is a perfect fit with some of the things we've been talking about today. Here we go. Never mind if you hear yourself saying the same good things over and over. Never mind. Saying things you need to hear repeatedly will establish them in you. Would you choose not to have a little chant about the good things you want if you knew that would pull them in? Tell me, what would you say to yourself instead? There is nothing you could say that would have more value than the good things you want to see established in your life. So find your little chant and say it over and over. Thank you, and see you next time.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.